Okay, so welcome everybody. Not sure if everyone's back yet. So what you're seeing on the screen there is Sutta Central, and so we're just sort of while we're waiting for people, I can just show off what we're doing in Sutta Central. For those of you who haven't seen it, so this is a new website which we're working on, and here on the we have the first sutta in the Digha, the Brahmajala Sutta, and on the right we have the Pali text, and on the left we have the English translation. So this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's English translation, and we can so one of the fun things that we can do with this is we have the Pali English dictionary lookup, so that's now enabled on this Pali page, so when you're reading it, if you want to read the Pali and the English side by side, you can see that's what I heard. On one occasion, Buddha, between Rajagaha and between Nalanda, was travelling along the path with, and there's a with here, with a great sangha of bhikkhus. So notice here, it hasn't broken up the compound properly. We've got the Sanghena, and for some reason it hasn't recognized the ena ending there. So sometimes when you're having a lookup to recognize Pali, you have to actually pass the Pali grammar. You can't just look it up letter by letter, right? But the program has to understand the Pali grammar to be able to recognize the words properly. So it does that reasonably well, but not perfectly in every case. So sometimes we get it right and sometimes not. Together with 500 bhikkhus and Suppiyopi, so that's not recognised because it's a proper name, and we've nearly got our dictionary of proper names ready, but that's not quite ready yet. Suppiyo ko the Paribhajiko, the wanderer, was also wandering between Rajagaha and Nalanda along the road, together with his student, Andavasina, and that should be picked up, that's quite a common word, Andavasina, Brahmadattena, Manavena, the young Brahman student. And their pleonistic particle, their indeed, or something like that, Sophia Paribhajika, and many ways, Aneka Pariyena Buddhasa, Avanang Bahasati, spoke in dispraise of the Buddha. Dhamma Avanang Bahasati, spoke in dispraise of the Dhamma. Sanghasa Avanang Bahasati. It's curious, it picks up Buddhasa and Dhammasa, but not Sanghasa. I should check why that is. Avanang Bahasati. So the teacher and the student spoke in many ways. Iti hat te. So that's both the teacher and the student mutually uju vipacchanika vada. So this is a very unusual word. In this case, it's not picking it up because it's probably just not found in the dictionary. So in direct contradiction with what it means with the Buddha. So the student and teacher were directly contradicting each other while following closely behind the Buddha and the Bhikkhu Sangha. So that's how this works, and if you want to find more details, you can click on the entry there, and then that will go to the full entry in the dictionary of Bhikkhu, for example. So then you can get the whole long dictionary entry. So you get the brief dictionary entry for just the hovering above it, and then the full dictionary entry if you click on the head word, and that will take you to that.
Does it have chanting?
Does it have chanting stuff? It has the canons, the early Buddhist texts. Metta-sutta is a sutta. Itipiso is a common passage which you find in many suttas. So So those things you find in there somewhere, but it doesn't have it like a chanting book or something like that. But those passages, if those passages are in the Yoga Suttas, you'll find them there. If they're not, you won't.
Can I read it out to you?
Not yet, but we're working on that. Yeah. You last, right? But no, but that's absolutely fundamental, and we're building that in right to the way that we're coding the texts. And this part of what we're doing is the philosophy behind it is we think that the Buddha's words should be available to anybody. And so if somebody has visibility issues, if they're blind or kind of hard to read or whatever, then they should be able to study the Buddha's words as well. So Venerable Nandiya typically went away and built a voice synthesizing program for Pali. Okay? So that's already been made, but we haven't worked out how to actually implement it on the website yet, but that will take some time.
That will really help learning the language.
Mm. Absolutely. What we have done, it's not quite as good as that yet, but what we've done is this one. So you can now break up the Pali into syllables with underlining the long syllables. So this is to help with learning chanting. You can actually emphasize the long syllables. So that's a kind of a breakup thing. And then you can, of course, read the Pali text if you prefer to read it in Thai script or in Sinhala or in Burmese, for example, or in Devanagari, then you can do that. It's the same text, but it's just in the different scripts. And because the Pali is written, Indian languages are written in phonetic alphabets, so that you can just make a one-to-one substitution and put it between all the different scripts, the same language. Yeah.
I'm not sure that search function might give you on the search if you know the name of the sutta, or can you search for topics?
What do you want to search for?
Like if you wanted to search for something on a particular topic, could you do that, or just do you have to know?
Give me an example. Okay, what you can do at the moment the search is not finished and we're working hard on improving the search, but what the search is very good for now is finding suttas if you have an address of a sutta, okay, or you have like a number or something like that. So let's say I want to find the Satipatthana Sutta, then I know that's Majjhima Nikaya number 10, and I write MN10 in there, bingo, there's the Satipatthana Sutta. So that's how fast it is if you want to actually find the sutta.
Yeah. Could we have found it just quickly if we just came in Satipatthana?
You can. So you can write Satipatthana, you don't have to put any of the diacritical marks or anything like that, and you'll also find it just as quickly. Yeah? So finding from the sutta titles, or if you say another sutta title might be, say, the Brahmajala Sutta, which is what we were looking at before, and then just type in a few letters and it'll pick that up and give me the instant search for the Brahmajala Sutta. Yeah, so that's there. The actual Pali text is here. This is the reference number, table of parallels, and so on. And here is the translations in English, German, and Vietnamese.
So if I put in, say, dependent origination or something, will it bring up?
It may or may not. I'm not sure. But at the moment, from the main search, we don't actually have full text search yet. So you know, getting it there. Yeah, at the moment it's only title search, so we're working on the full text search. And when we implement the full text search, one of the things that we'd want to be doing, but what you can do, it actually does have full text search, but it's just not available from that box because it's still a bit primitive. You just have to go to the Google custom search here, and then that will be dependent origination there. So then you can find some suttas on dependent origination, but that's just a basic Google search, so that's not so precise. But what you will be able to do, and what we're working on is what we want to be able to do is to try to treat the whole corpus of early Buddhist texts as one body of scripture, because that's actually what it is, right? These things are essentially the same thing. And they should be treated as the same thing. It just happens to be the case that half of them are in Pali and half are in Chinese, and then a few scatterings in Tibetan and so on. So they're treated almost always as completely different things, because people only know one or other of those languages, and there's very few translations. So we want to treat it as one unified corpus of literature. So, for example, you'll be able to search, and you want to search for mindfulness, and then that will search for all the entries of Sati in the Pali, of Smriti in the Sanskrit, of Nian in the Chinese, and of whatever mindfulness is in Tibetan, I don't know. But so, and with one search, then you can pull all the references to those things down in those different texts. So this is kind of multi, sort of looking up multi language search by using the various dictionaries and synonyms and things that have been written. So this is what we're working on producing at the moment. And of course that will be most effective. Obviously it's useful for scholars in the meantime, but obviously it will be most effective when we have lots of translations. At the moment we only have a limited number of translations, but we do have some good ones, and of course I can't resist showing you this one. Which is obviously the most important sutra in the whole early Buddhist literature.
But then, what happens if it is, doesn't know anything about Buddhism, somebody comes to this website, mm-hmm. know anything, mm. so I mean they don't know anything about sutras? Or
yeah, then they're stuffed.
No,
we can't. One of the things I think is really important when you're designing websites is you don't try to be all things to all people. Yeah, you try to do one thing really, really, really well. Yeah, and that's basically, you know, this is one thing that I've learned, because we've been doing this website for years, and it's one of the things that I kind of learned by watching what happens on the internet. And you compare Google and Yahoo. That's basically the difference. Yahoo tries to be everything for everybody. You open up the Yahoo homepage and it gives you all loads of crap that you don't want. Google does one thing and one thing well. Yeah? So this is, I think, really the lesson. So in that sense, it's not so much, I don't think thinking about it as a website is even a useful way of thinking about it. It's not a website, it's a way of accessing the Buddhist scriptures. And it happens to be that in this form, we're using that web interface as a way of helping to bring those scriptures to you. But if we were to use another form, for example, it was an app or a Kindle document or something like that, then we'd design it in a different way, but it would be the same thing in the sense that the point is, how do we bring that content to people as quickly as possible? So if somebody wants basic information on Buddhism, go to Wikipedia or Buddhanet or one of a million other sites, and we're not going to do that. Yeah. So this is for people who want to learn more about the early Buddhist sutras. Yeah.
Is there a help section there?
There is, yeah, we've got some help sections and things, yeah, we do, yeah. So there's various help sections and things like that, but I hate them. I tried to get the guys to say, well, let's not have help sections, I hate help sections. When's the last time that anybody's ever used a help section on a website?
Found a help section useful on a website.
No.
Anyone here ever? No, I can't remember the last time. Yeah. So anyway, so the guy said, no, we'll do a help section. So fine, we have a help section. So you're most welcome to go and read it, but I wouldn't worry about it. I just play around with it and see what you find. Yeah. What we will do, and this is something that will happen later on, is we want to develop localized versions. So that would be a bit like Wikipedia. Like when you open up Wikipedia, you get by default the English language site or the Chinese site or whatever it is that you want. And your browser will remember that and will deliver that site to you. So what we want to do eventually is develop localized versions. So when you open it up, you'll get the English language site and everything will be in English. Yeah, all the Pali and so on will go away and you'll just have English translations. Similarly, if you want to read it in French, you'll just have the French translations or whatever it is. And then we'll have the way it is now will be more or less like the expert mode, right? So that's for people who know some Pali and so on, want to look at the original text and they can read it like that. So down the track we'll do that, but for the moment our main concern is to bring on more content and to fill out the content. There's not much point in doing the localized versions if we don't have the actual texts in those different languages. So the first thing to do is to bring all those texts from different languages on board. As we were just negotiating earlier, how to get the English translations is the key, the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. This is the single most important thing. Many of the other things we already have, and it's just a matter of time to get the time to put them on there, the Vietnamese, the Korean, and Sinhalese, and so on. But the English ones, the publishers being a bit what would be the word?
Uncooperative,
recalcitrant.
Difficult.
They are offering us the opportunity to develop our compassion and wisdom, and especially patience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there are great bodhisattvas at the moment.
From Wisdom Publication.
That's right. Yeah. So, anyway, so this is sort of central. And I know that the thing that most of you will be wondering about, and that the point which will be the utmost in your minds, is you will have looked at this and you will have said, where we are going, politics. You will have said, when you looked at that, you said, but hang on, am I seeing right? This has the M's with the dot underneath the M. Isn't that evil? Huh? Shouldn't the dots be above the M? Isn't that cool? Well, yes, you're right, because you just do that and all the dots go above the M. Because when they print Pali, there's actually there's two ways of doing it, with the dots above the M and the dots below the M, and it has the same meaning. But anyway, Pali scholars have big arguments about this. We had a big argument in our team about which one it should be, and I unfortunately got outvoted. So the M got put below the dot got put below the M. So then Venerable Nandi is very compassionate, and he's also very smart, and he wrote a little script which will automatically change them all. So that when I read it, I don't have to read it with the dots below the M. That's different. You see, if you're reading Pali, the dot below the M, see, this is the thing, is that the dot below the N means it's a retroflex. Okay? And the dot above the N means it's nasal. So if you find a dot below, it's a dot above the N. Not so common, but you find a dot above the end somewhere. Where are we?
Your three lines above.
Anyamanyasa? No, that's a squiggle. That's a different one.
P-O-P.
P-O-P? Mm-hmm. Where are we? It's a P-O-P.
Third line.
It's a P-O-P. No, there's no dots above the end. I can't see any. It's not so common. Anyway, so you can get but they have a different meaning, right? So the dot underneath the N is a retroflex, which is pronounced na. So that's avarna, avarnang bahasati. And with the dot above is a nasal, so that's sangha, something like that, yeah? So actually you can spell that with an N, because sangha, but they spelled it with an M there. But the M with the dot underneath is actually nasal. So it's actually pronounced the same way as an N with the dot above. So this is why it's confusing. That's why it should be consistent. And this should always be the retroflex, and this should be the it should be like that. That is attention to detail. Okay, or a big waste of time. But anyway, so this is sort of central. Okay. So let us return to the task at hand, and we are here. And okay, so for this afternoon session, we've finished looking at. If you like, in the morning we focused more on the subjective side of wisdom, like what's the psychology of wisdom, how does it work, what's the process by which wisdom manifests. For this afternoon, I'd like to focus more on the content of wisdom, if you like. What kinds of things do we want to understand? Right? Not so much what is understanding, but what do we want to understand? And there are, of course, many different expressions of this. And what I'd like to do is just do a brief survey of some of these things, like the fields of wisdom. They sometimes call them the Vipassana Bhumi, the field of insight. And so we can just have a bit of a survey of that, and then hopefully have some time to look in some more detail at some of the suttas which were given as readings for today. So I'm not going to deal with these at all in any satisfactory way. I'm just going to just give a very brief overview of these things. So that, of course, the most important and the most general statement on wisdom and understanding in Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths. Huh? All of the teachings of the Buddha can be encompassed within the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the origin of suffering, ending of suffering, and the path. Okay, so suffering, birth, aging, and death is suffering, and so on. The origin of suffering is that craving that leads to future rebirth. Yayang dangha bono bhavika. Ending of suffering is the ending of that very same craving, and the path is, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay. So all of the teachings that we find on wisdom can be connected with or fit within these teachings on the Four Noble Truths. So another way that we find wisdom talked about very often in Buddhism is in terms of the three characteristics, sometimes four characteristics. Most commonly in the Theravadan tradition, you almost always find the three characteristics. Whereas if you listen to the Tibetan, certainly the Tibetan tradition, I'm not quite sure with the Chinese, but I think also the Chinese tradition, they'll often call the four characteristics, or actually they often use the word the four seals. I don't know if you've heard that kind of idiom, they say the four seals. Yeah, so the four seals is not for performing aquatic mammals, okay? It's not that kind of seals. Actually, it's the same word. It's like this idea that everything in reality is stamped with a sign, right? So it's similar to the meaning of the characteristic. It's actually the original. Harks back to the same word. But usually in the Tibetan tradition, they have four rather than three, and the reason for that was because they add emptiness to the three. And what you find in the we were looking before at sort of central, and at the different versions of suttas in the different from the different backgrounds. And typically what you find, and I wonder whether I can actually find an example of this. I'll go to that in just a second. I'll just explain that, what these mean in just a minute. Impermanence, of course. Things end. Suffering. Ow. They hurt. Not self. Huh? So usually, of course, not self is the most challenging, I guess, of the three characteristics, not self. Anyway, the most difficult, at least on an intellectual level, the most difficult to understand. Emptiness is that. Now, in the early Buddhist texts, emptiness actually is really used more or less as a synonym of not self, actually very similar. And these things are all very closely connected anyway. But in the Sanskrit scriptures, they tend to use. Let's see if I can get this quickly. I might find this, but I can't get it quickly. I might not. In the Tibetan, what you find is that one of the things that I just want to point out here is that one of the things that's interesting, even though it doesn't really make any difference, right? Whether you mention emptiness in there or not, actually doesn't really change the substance of it. But it's more just a textual tradition which actually stems back to quite an early time. And I'm just looking in here for an example where that might be the case. So this is a teaching from a Tibetan canon on, it talks about not self, but it doesn't mention emptiness here. Oh, that's quite interesting actually. Yeah, this is a Anyway, this is quite interesting in its own right. Doesn't quite say what I was looking for, but here's a sutta from the text called the Upayaka, which is a Tibetan translation of a Sanskrit text which compiles a whole bunch of early suttas. This has been recently translated by Samaneri Dhammadina. So this is the first time that this work has been available in English. Previously, it's only been translated into Japanese, the only modern language. Very obscure work in Tibetan, very little studied within the Tibetan tradition, but a very important source of early Buddhist texts. And so here we have, the Upayaka has several hundred either full suttas or extensive passages from early Buddhist texts. And here's just one version, one sutta, which Samaneri Dhammadina is working on this as an ongoing project. She's translated a few of the suttas, and she's working on a full translation and critical edition of the text, and that will be coming out sometime in the next, well, before the end of the eon anyway, but she does seem to be working, she is working on it actively, so hopefully it won't be too long. So here's just a typical example. This is an early Buddhist style text from the Tibetan tradition. The narrative introduction is Sāvatthī, so notice how it's abbreviating the usual introduction. The Buddha was staying in Sāvatthī, at Jetta's grove, and so on. So this text is now just abbreviating that for us. It assumes we already know that. Monks, whatever the causes and whatever the conditions for the arising of bodily forms, is rūpa, these are just impermanent. How could bodily forms that have come into being in dependence on impermanent causes and conditions themselves be permanent? Whatever the causes and whatever the conditions for the arising of feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, of course this being the five aggregates, these are just impermanent. How could consciousness that has come into being in dependence on impermanent causes and conditions itself be permanent? Monks, bodily form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness are impermanent. What is impermanent? That is dukkha, suffering. What is impermanent? That is dukkha. So that's repeated. And actually, I should check that with Samaneri Dhammadina to make sure that that's... There might be a mistake in the translation, or it might be a mistake in the actual text. Not sure. What is dukkha? That is not self. What is not self should be seen with right wisdom as this is not me, this is, cannot be grasped as mine, this cannot be grasped as my own self. So notice here, it doesn't have the fourth characteristic. It still just has anicca, dukkha, anatta. Yeah? And so this text then goes on. Monks, a learned, noble disciple who contemplates in this way will become disenchanted with regard to bodily forms and will likewise become disenchanted with regard to feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. When he's becoming disenchanted, he'll be free from desire. When he's free from desire, he'll be liberated. When he's liberated, knowledge and vision of complete liberation arise, namely that birth for me has been exhausted, the holy life has been fulfilled, what had to be done has been done. Existence other than the present one shall not be known by me, which is a somewhat obscure phrase, but it just means I'm not going to get reborn. Thus it was said, and this is the ending tag for that particular text. So this is one of the texts, again one of the several hundred texts available in the Upayaka. If anyone's read any of the suttas, especially in Samyutta Nikaya, and the Kanda Samyutta will recognize this particular style of sutta. There's many suttas that are very similar to this in the Samyutta. And I'm sure if we looked for the parallels, we can find on Sutta Central easily enough the exact parallels in Pali. But what you'll certainly find is that, as with all of these texts, you know, we're finding is exactly the same thing that we find in the Pali texts. Yeah? Again, I'm emphasizing that these early Buddhist texts, we're not talking about a generic similarity. We're not talking about things that have a same kind of feel or similar kind of ideas or a same kind of outlook. We're finding different recensions of exactly the same texts. And so we can find a text which will be almost exactly the same word for word with that in the Pali. And we can see there's no intrusion, even though this is passed down with the Tibetan tradition. And we know that there are, you know, many things which are characteristic of Tibetan Buddhism, but there's no intrusion of those Tibetan Buddhist ideas into the early Buddhist texts whatsoever. They just translate the text, okay? And so it just remains as it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's one aspect of that collection of things that always jars me, and probably with everybody else. And it's because of our culture. Our culture already embraces the idea that there is a self.
Uh-huh.
That there isn't. So when you read, is it right that this should be considered myself?
Yeah.
The implication is the self is somewhere else, because we already know there is one, but it's not there. It's not to be found there, it's to be found somewhere else. You're following me. So my question is, do you think
I'm not following you 100%, but go on.
Do you think it's significant of a different worldview, of a significantly different worldview at the Buddha's time, but it's expressed that way, and it's expressed that way throughout all the texts, so that there was no confusion then, but there is confusion now, because if you show that text to non-Buddhists, they think by saying, so monks, is it right that what is impermanent, what is suffering, well, that should be considered myself? And they say no.
Yeah.
A worldling today thinks, therefore, the self is to be found somewhere else, rather than there is no self.
I think that's fair enough. But I think that the what we're dealing with the five khandhas, right? Okay, so this is the teaching on the five khandhas, five aggregates. And I think that five aggregates, the main purpose of it, I think the original purpose of it, was a scheme of classifying theories of the self. Okay? So each, and this is actually, you can find within the Buddhist texts, it's used in this way, but you can also find, if you look in the Upanishads and the non-Buddhist texts, that they will tend to identify the selves in terms of one or other of those khandhas or some mixture of them. Yeah? So what I think that we're seeing here is that this was accepted sort of currency, that these five khandhas were, in fact, a classification scheme. So if you were going to propose a theory of the self, it was going to fit somewhere within those five khandhas. Right? And the Buddha was saying, no, it can't be any of those. Therefore, there is no self. Yeah? So in that sense, yes, I think you're quite right that there is definitely a cultural difference in how it's presented. Yeah.
It never leads on to say that last bit, therefore this is... No, it never actually...
which is a kind of interesting little detail. A detail which has been made too much of in some quarters, I think. But, I mean, when the Buddha says, sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are not self, then to me that's basically saying the same thing as there is no self. I don't know how you could say all dhammas are not self, but there is a self. Yeah. Okay. So this is just giving you one example of how these teachings are presented, and you can see that characteristic of the Buddha's style, that the teachings are given in a very direct way. Most of the time the teachings are given in a fairly unadorned way, right? There's a teaching which is based in experience. So he's pointing to the experience that people have. So there's nothing talked about here which everybody here doesn't know about. You all know what physical form is. You all know what feelings are. You all know what perceptions are. You all know what intentions are. You all know what consciousness is. Yeah. You might not know these things completely, but at least you have some idea what they are, and you have some experience of it, and you know what impermanence is, and so on. So it's based on your experience. And it's giving you a framework for being able to investigate that experience. And of course, this is something which can and should be used for as a meditation. And this is one of the things which is actually very nice if you memorize some of these texts which are very dry when you're reading them. The very dryness and repetitiveness of them is what makes them really useful when you're reciting them and you're meditating. You can actually go through them one by one as you're reciting, and you go through each one and investigate and reflect on it as you're doing the recitation. And so that way it's very powerful. Okay. So... Oops. Okay, so that's the three characteristics. So, yeah, usually in the Theravadan tradition, the three, and sometimes in the Tibetan and other traditions, the four characteristics. Okay, another aspect of the fields of wisdom is the five aggregates. And form, feeling, perception, sankharas is the basically means intention, activities of the mind, and vijnana is consciousness. And in that grouping of five things, we find what I think is a very subtle and very powerful analysis of, you know, this, about what a person is. It's very, it moves in a very comprehensible way from what is quite coarse, from the body, towards more subtle aspects of awareness. And the last one, and the most subtle, is consciousness itself, okay, which is just the awareness, which is the awareness of all of those other things. Interestingly enough, in Buddhism, we don't find a mind-body dualism, okay, in early Buddhist texts. We do find in modern Buddhism, they often talk about the mind and body. There's no phrase that means mind and body in early Buddhism, okay? And there's no analysis in early Buddhism which is based on that dichotomy of the mind and the body. Right? When this is treated in terms of a dualism, what we find is that it's not body on the one hand, and then this is all mind. That's not how it's divided up. It's divided up as consciousness, yeah, on the one hand, and everything else together is what. If this is awareness, and this is what we are aware of, yeah. So if there is a dualism in early Buddhism, it's a dualism of awareness and what we are, and the objects of awareness, what we are aware of. Yeah? So the mind-body dualism is not found in early Buddhism.
Why activities usually is mental formations?
But mental formations isn't English. Who goes around with mental formations?
Funny.
They call Buddhist hybrid English. Yeah, you have to learn a special English vocabulary before you know it. Yeah.
Activities, does that describe sankhara?
Yeah, that's what sankhara means, activities, energies. Perhaps energies might be another way. It's actually defined as intention. So you could, one of the compromises you have to make in translating Pali is whether you translate something to in accord with the meaning in that particular context, or whether you try to show them how it's used in the different contexts. Yeah, we want one rendering that will fit all the different contexts. So if you use a rendering like activities, it's maybe a little bit awkward in that context, but it allows you to use it across more broad broad examples. But actually, specifically in that case, it means intention. Yeah, volitional formations, again, not being an actual English word. Right? Sure, yeah. Volitional formations and so on. There's the different forms that people use. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this is the, yeah, but this is the, oh, that's right, we have the dot above and blah, blah. Yes, thank you very much. So this is correctly done, of course. And here we have the dot above signifying nasal, sankhara. And the dot below signifying retroflex, vinyarna, with the tongue curled up to the tip of the mouth, vinyarna. No, 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 mind and body is not in the early text. Mind and body, Namarupa doesn't mean mind and body. Yeah? And this is the problem. They translate Namarupa as meaning mind and body, it doesn't mean that at all. Not, at least not in the early texts. It does in the later Abhidhamma tradition, but in early Buddhism, Nama-rupa doesn't mean mind and body at all. Well, what do you think it means?
Name and body.
Name and body, yeah. Nama means name, right? And form, yeah. So that's actually quite a different meaning to mind and body, right? In the suttas, Nama-rupa is actually a subtle topic. It's treated, one of the most interesting ones is in the Mahanidana Sutta, which I think was in the reading for this week. And so that gives a very... Wasn't Mahanidana in the reading?
No.
No, it wasn't. Okay, so you missed that. Anyway, Mahanidana Sutta. But it's actually treated in a very, very subtle way in the suttas, yeah? which is much more nuanced. But what nama basically means, well, if you look at what the compound of nama-rupa and what it's actually getting at, nama-rupa is one of those many ideas which you find in Buddhism which the Buddha was adopting from the pre-Buddhist heritage, right? And when he was speaking to people who understood the Brahmanical and other uses of it, right? But the later Buddhists didn't know that non-Buddhist context, right? They didn't know what the Brahmins knew, so they understood nama-rupa in a purely Buddhist way, which actually misrepresented what the original purpose of it was. And if you look at what Nama Rupa looks, means historically, if you trace it back through time, what actually does Nama Rupa mean? Why is this strange compound there, name and form? What is it actually getting at? What's the point of having name and form? If what we really mean to talk about is mind and body, why do we use such a curious thing? I mean, surely if you know Pali, if you wanted to say mind and body, you'd say chitta kaya or something like that. That's a much more straightforward way of saying mind and body. So why do we use name and form to say mind and body? Well, the reason is it's got nothing to do with mind and body. Rupa originally means forms, as in things that you see, right? So this is the basic meaning, forms or shapes. Nama is names of things, right? So if you think about it in a very basic, primitive way, that's what it means. I see a shape of a cup, and I call it a cup. This is a rupa, what I'm seeing. The nama is the name that I give to that rupa. That's what nama rupa means, yeah? That's the basic meaning of nama rupa. So when we're talking about nama rupa in a psychological or philosophical sense, what we're talking about is that conceptual complex, right, that gives us a framework for being able to name and understand all the things around us in the world and being able to manipulate that. We know this is a tree, this is a cow, this is a tiger, and so on and so forth. We have names. Think about Genesis, right? Yeah? Adam goes around in the Garden of Eden giving names to all the animals, right? There's nama rupa. There's these forms, and you're giving names to them. That's what children do when they grow up. They learn names for all the forms that they encounter in the world. So what does that mean? Well, as you do that, of course, you're learning to make sense of the world, right? You've got labels, you understand them, you're understanding the world. So nama rupa is a sense of understanding the world. And so the meaning of nama rupa in Buddhism essentially is this conceptual framework for all the diverse things that we have in the world. And this is why nama rupa is said to stand against or to be dependent on, mutually dependent on, vijnana or consciousness. Yeah? So that all the things that we are aware of, the things that we know, all the forms, the different things, we are aware of them with our consciousness, the vijnana. Yeah? The vijnana is the knowing. And the Buddha was adopting this specifically in contrast with the Upanishadic view. And in the Upanishadic view, the simile is given that just like every river has its own name and its own shape. Yeah? So notice that this is what nama rupa means. It's like an individuality, right? They're each separate. Each river has their separate name, their separate shape, but they all come down to that great ocean, which is the ocean of consciousness, and they lose their nama and their rupa. Huh? This is the Upanishadic view. And the Buddha said that the nama rupa is dependent on vijnana, and vijnana is dependent on nama rupa. So it's not that all of the individual names and shapes end in that infinite consciousness, but that both of these are dependent on each other, and when one ends, the other ends. Right?
How can name and form be dependent on consciousness?
Could
they, regardless of your consciousness,
become
another consciousness?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, but your name and form won't. No, it won't. Somebody else will have a different form, right? Which they will put the same label onto. And that's where the idea of permanence comes from. Right? But it won't be your name and form. Your consciousness is dependent on your names and forms. Yeah? Yeah, that's right, how you perceive it. Yeah. And that's precisely where the illusion of permanence comes from. Right? Because we have one name for a changing form. Yeah? I'm still Sujato. I was Sujato 5 minutes ago, and an hour before, and yesterday, and 10 years ago, the name was still the same, but actually I'm changing. Names can change as well, but the changes of names don't necessarily have anything to do with the changes of the things themselves.
Are there examples of sankhara?
It's volition. It means intention. Yeah.
So wouldn't that volition or intention be really there in that context?
It would be.
It's much more than a progression from feeling, perception,
It is, and you know, you're probably right, it's probably better off to translate it in that way. It's the only reason you translate it in sankharas is because it's used in different contexts, and activities is a more kind of general word that will apply in all different contexts, that's all. But specifically in this context, you use it as intention would be better.
Okay. I've been interpreting it all the time as volition or intention, and I found it easy enough to make sense of it whenever it's used. Yes, it can be, the activity is more of a subset than the main moment, the volition or intention.
Yeah, the point I'm making is that the same word is used in completely different contexts. So if you hear a word like, say, sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent, in that context, sankharas does not mean intentions. Right? So it means all conditioned things. So you can translate both of those as activities, and so then you can preserve the connection between those two different contexts. So that's just one of the compromises that you make as a translator. Do you translate to be more specific in the context, or do you try to keep the connections? So, yeah, generally speaking, what the translation style, which was started by Venerable Nyanamoli and then developed by Bhikkhu Bodhi, was to try to, as much as possible, preserve the one translated term, especially for the technical terms, to keep one translated term in all the different contexts. And there are good reasons for that, because there are meanings and nuances and connections which you pick up by recognizing the occurrence of the word in different contexts.
Yes.
It's peculiar to the idiom of the suttas, because part of the idiom of the suttas is that you have little snippets of things in all different places, and you have to pick up those little snippets and gradually learn the connections between them, because it's not sort of explained systematically all in one place. So that was why that they translated in that way, so that you can gradually learn, this word here is the same word that's being used in that different context in that one, and it's the same word used in a different context in that one, and by we pulling those three together, then I can really understand what that word is.
So this is
the problem. So we just have to, this is why when we're reading it, not to be too worried about what the translated term is, and just try to look for what's the meaning of it. Yeah.
What's the difference between chetana and sankhara?
In this context, none. Yeah. Chetana is sankhara, that's how it's defined, when it's defined. Yeah. Yes?
Just like the Shanghai, how the terms and books, physical phenomena and natural phenomena, does that fit now?
That's a better way of putting it, rather than mind and body. Yeah, because mind and body are like objects, aren't they? Yeah, they're like things, whereas physical phenomena, mental phenomena, yeah, things that you experience. So that's a better way of putting it. Yeah.
Looking at vijnana,
yeah,
it often arises in the suttas as the process of contact between the eye and the form, such a here and now, immediate action. And yet in English, consciousness seems to be more often associated with a state, the conscious as opposed to being unconscious.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Does that same dual meaning arise in Pali as well? And what's the meaning of vijnana in this context?
Yeah, it's a bit awkward, and it's probably consciousness isn't the best translation for vijnana. Some perhaps awareness is a better one. So it just means the awareness of something. That's all.
So here it also means the process at the point in time when the eye comes in contact with the form.
Absolutely, yeah,
right.
Yeah, it has that same meaning, and it's used quite specifically in that way in Buddhism. Yeah, it mostly means that. Sometimes there's a more pregnant meaning of understanding, but usually it means awareness of an object.
Well, can we say becoming conscious of?
Yeah, you can.
Because when there's a contact, we become conscious of.
Yes, that's right, yeah, that's still preserved that kind of verbal sense of it.
Yeah. Which has nothing to do with the psychological consciousness.
That's right, yeah. And when I started reading some books on psychology, it took me ages to try to figure out what they were talking about, you know. I read Julian Jayne's Origin of Consciousness, and it took me until halfway through the book till I was actually figured out what he was meaning, you know. And he talks about the origin of consciousness. What he really means is the origin of a sense of self. Yeah, the origin of ability to reflect on yourself as being a subject of experience, which has got nothing to do with what vijnana means. Okay, so perception is actually more to do, I think, and Ankon will probably clarify this, I think it is used in that sense as a technical term in psychology, where perception is a process of recognizing and making sense of experience. Yeah, so recognizing that that's an elephant and that's a cow or something like that is what perception is. Vijnana is the most fundamental of anything. Vijnana is the awareness of, it's the subject, it's the ultimate subject of every object. You know, and this is the thing this is where the Upanishads made this, you know, tremendous advance and this tremendous insight. And you see this constantly through the Upanishads, it's like 100 or 200 years before the Buddha. And they're always talking about, like the Ajnavalkya is always talking about the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. That is yourself. Yeah? And there's this beautiful simile, they give this simile where Pamazan is saying, what is the self? What is the Atman? And he says, get me a seed. And he says, okay, he says, peel off the outer layer of this seed. And he peels off the outer layer and says, now peel off the inner husk. And he peels off the inner husk. And he says, okay, now peel off the flesh of the seed. And he peels off that. And then he's got the kernel. And then he peels off breaks open the kernel of the seed. And he says, what's left? And he says, there's nothing there. And he says, ah, that's yourself. Yeah? So these Upanishads are always going towards the subject. They're always asking, you know, who am I? Who am I? And they're always discarding any externals and saying, this is not myself. So actually, you know, you find in the Upanishads, it's very close to this Buddhist idea of not self. Yeah? Neti, neti is what Yajnavalkya used to say. Neti, neti, not that, not that, not that. Yeah? But then it comes back and ultimately there is a self. But it's just none of those things we take for itself, but it's just that consciousness, vijnana ghanameva, that sheer mass of consciousness. So this again was that extra step which the Buddha took and said, even that sense of pure subjectivity and pure knowing is not self.
When you just been explaining something else about the difference between perception of sanya and vijnana,
mm-hmm.
You can't unfortunately remove that word, mm-hmm. but suddenly that became in my mind confused with name and form. And so and I'm just wondering whether then the reason for the use of consciousness instead of awareness
mm-hmm.
is this correct? Right? Is that mm-hmm. somehow or other it is still bringing, it is more a, there's awareness that includes the self. You know, even though it's not,
uh-huh.
it's an awareness that includes this as well as that. And uh-huh. I'm aware that it's not, this is not self, but the awareness at the level of vijnana goes beyond just awareness of beyond name and form, beyond just offense and distinguish. Yeah, suddenly it's all getting muddled.
Yeah, it's sounding good. Yeah. Well, just keep it simple. Keep it simple. Vijnana is just the awareness of something. Okay? Very simple. Yeah, awareness of something. So the other things are the things on which awareness depends. Yeah?
Perception being hearing.
No, perception being a process of recognition by which we make sense of sensory objects.
And how is that then different from
knowing and form? It's not necessarily different from, it's actually very closely related to it, yeah? Mm-hmm. Perception, in the analysis of nama rupa, perception is one of the factors in nama. It's part of that process. So the answer to your question is it's not different. It's a different way of talking about the same thing.
Right, and so then I suppose it's become more going back to where we started,
mm.
is then vijnana is more refined.
Vijnana is not part of nama rupa, yeah? So nama rupa on the whole covers the same ground. Oops.
Nama Rupa on the whole covers the same ground as the first four aggregates.
Yes.
And then Vijnana is that which is aware of all those other things. Yeah. Make sense? Different to what?
I thought I understood it 30 seconds ago.
Ah, that's the beginnings of true wisdom.
But can it be like the form would be, for example, a baby, and the feeling is the love and which like a mother feels for her baby,
uh-huh.
and then that arousing of taking care on this very nice thing, and the perception is, hey, that's my baby.
Uh-huh.
I gave birth, I waited for 9 years, and then the activity is in the sense of taking care on the physical side, on the mental side, and the consciousness is, I'm a mother, I'll do
Oh, you're doing well up to there. But consciousness, everyone's trying to make consciousness too complicated. Consciousness is brutally simple. As soon as you give it any qualities, it's not consciousness anymore. Consciousness is just the awareness of everything else. Yeah? So consciousness knows. Consciousness is like the whiteness of the screen. Yeah? Yeah? And so you're trying to say, does the screen have to be partly black in order to represent the letters? No. The whiter the screen is, the more those other things will show. Yeah? That's the crucial thing. That's why when we're meditating, we have to clean our consciousness. You clean your awareness, because the brighter that is, the more clearly everything will display on that screen. Yeah? So this is very, very, it's very important to resist the temptation to give those qualities to consciousness. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Absolutely, and in that sense, that's right. So consciousness, often used in psychology in a more pregnant sense, to be like a reflective awareness of something. You're aware that you're aware of something. But as you're saying, even animals have consciousness, definitely, in the Buddhist sense, yeah? So any kind of animal definitely has consciousness in the Buddhist sense. Interesting point on that is that there was this release quite recently, I think, from the Cambridge neuroscientists. Did anybody see that? There's a bunch of neuroscientists and scientists from Cambridge have put out this statement, kind of a formal statement affirming that animals have consciousness, and that basically that therefore they should be considered as ethically having rights. Something like that, yeah. On this day of July 7, 2012, okay, so it was about a year ago, a prominent international group of cognitive neuroscientists, neuropharmacologists, neurophysiologists, neuroanatomists, and computational, that all sounds very impressive, doesn't it? Computational neuroscientists and your average Joe Blows gathered at the University of Cambridge to reassess the neurobiological substrates of conscious experience and related behaviours in human and non-human animals. Blah, 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 blah. The following observations can be stated unequivocally. So formal statements, and we declare the following: the absence of a neocortex does not appear to preclude an organism from experiencing affective states. So this is the word that they're using here: affective states, meaning something like what we're talking about with Vijnana, huh? That you actually have a subjective experience. Convergent evidence indicates that non-human animals have the neuroanatomical, neurochemical, and neurophysiological substrates of conscious states, along with the capacity to exhibit intentional behaviors. Consequently, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. Non-human animals, including all mammals of birds and many other creatures, including octopuses, also possess these neurological substrates. And this is the thing I like most about this thing. They made a special mention of octopuses.
Yeah.
Right. But they seem to be quite intelligent, don't they? Yeah, they've got highly, highly developed.
The difference of the scientists,
uh-huh.
I think they're using the word consciousness here, not the way we are saying today. Uh-huh. I think they're using it in terms of the psychology use of the word consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're actually confirming what the Buddha is saying.
Mm.
Because the Buddha says all sentient beings,
right.
They are talking about the octopus is a sentient being.
Sentient being, essentially, yeah.
So it has a mind.
Yeah.
And the mind is able to be conscious in those ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's ethics to the mind.
Right.
But today, when we use consciousness under the five aggregates, which is what you said earlier, it's much simpler.
Yeah. It's just awareness of,
one step in the process.
Yeah.
Would a computer have consciousness?
Well, you have to come along to our cyborg geek that we're doing in a few months' time and we'll find out the answer to that. We're doing a whole talk on cyborgs, artificial intelligence, and robots.
Depending on how you define it, if a machine is able to have self-awareness, would that count as consciousness?
Of course, yeah. So from a Buddhist point of view, the material basis of it is irrelevant. Yeah.
That means Google is alive.
No, it doesn't mean Google is alive. Okay, so we're a long way behind in where I'd hope to get by this day, but anyway, it's good conversation, so we might as well just continue until the break time. So here's another. So again, we're talking about the fields of wisdom. We've looked at the Four Noble Truths, three characteristics, five aggregates. The other very important one is the six senses: eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, body and touch, mind, and mental objects and mental processes. Of course, the striking thing about this particular list from a Western psychological point of view is the inclusion of the mind as being somehow kind of parallel to these other senses. Yeah? And so this is giving us a framework for investigating how consciousness works. This particular framework, I think, is the most useful and most practical for developing insight meditation, right? Because it's starting with things which are pretty straightforward and which we can investigate very clearly through the different sense consciousnesses. You can actually focus on the eye consciousness and so on, and really see what those things are like, learn what that experience is like, go into that more and more detail, analyze that experience, gradually go through all of them. And then you begin to see that the mind is actually working in a similar way. Obviously, the workings of the mind are much more complex than those other things, right? But the point of including it in the list there is that there's a similar dynamic, there's a similar process which is working. Yeah? And that process, I mean, in evolutionary terms, is probably no accident. I mean, the mind as an internal state has probably evolved in response to and as something of being able to manipulate and make sense of and use the information provided by the senses. So there's a definite relationship between them. So this is another very important aspect of wisdom development. Another one we have is the elements. This one perhaps not so important anyway in contemporary Buddhism because it's based on the ancient Indian theories of matter, which is the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. Of course, these are not really elements in the chemical sense. They're more closely related to the states of matter in chemistry, of being solid, liquid, gas, and the thing which transforms matter from those states is heat. Yeah. So actually, if you look at it in that way, as being like the states of matter, rather than elements, and it's coming a lot closer to what the ancient Indian view was. Space and consciousness are sometimes added as extras. So sometimes you find the five elements, the four elements, sometimes five, and occasionally six elements. Just one thing to note in passing, that the Buddhist perception or Buddhist understanding of space was very sophisticated in the early Buddhist texts. As with so many things, you find that the Buddha making a few passing references to things, and it's not like making a big deal of it. But actually, the philosophical status of space is actually a highly contested issue, right? Is space an actual thing, right? Or is space just an absence? Yeah. And in a lot of the Buddhist schools argue that space was an actual thing, right? So space had its own essence. And in different philosophical traditions and scientific traditions, there's also been this argument that space is an actual thing. If you remember, for example, in the 19th century, the controversy about the ether and about having that light had to have a medium to pass through. So there was this underlying assumption that somehow space had to be a thing which would be enabled to be a medium that light could propagate through. Whereas the Buddha didn't treat space in that way. The Buddha treated space as being something which was merely dependent on the other elements. Yeah? So it's in a sense that space is simply the absence of the other elements. That's a view which is becoming, I think, much more mainstream in modern science. So we don't think in modern science about space being a thing in itself anymore, but space as being something which is conditioned by the matter and energy distributed through the universe. Like if you think about the Big Bang, right, when the whole universe is kind of folded up in one little spot, there's no space there. Yeah? So space is only created when there's energy in motion. Anyway, so consciousness also included there. So each of these different analyses covers the same ground, but from a slightly different perspective. Yeah, and so sometimes it might be useful for different people with different characters or different kinds of contemplation. Yeah.
Could space not also be like the space you gain when you stop thinking? Like this eternal feeling?
In this context, space is only physical space.
It's only, because consciousness for me is not an element like the other one.
Yeah, it's a bit.
Space has some sort of this double, triple meaning.
No, it's meant here in a literal sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not in a metaphorical sense. Anything else? No? Okay. How does consciousness feature as an element?
Space is an absence of the first
four. Yeah. Consciousness doesn't quite fit in there, which is why actually most of the time it's not there. But sometimes it's brought in, mostly it's brought in when it's developing that kind of, if you were to develop the deep insight, is to, like to understand those things. And you understand that actually they only arise in dependence on consciousness. Yeah? But normally, actually, normally it's just the first four elements which I mentioned. Yeah. Yeah.
It's more one influence from physics, because there have been a physicist who, a Nobel Prize winning physicist who said that ultimately physics will have to explain the existence of consciousness if they're really going to be a theory of everything. They have to account for it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Consciousness. And that seems a good thing to be.
Oh, I think the Buddhist point of view is that matter and consciousness are fundamentally interdependent, and I think this is an expression of that. So it's not that consciousness is a random epiphenomenon of brains that happens to pop up at a certain point in evolution, but the consciousness is there right from the beginning. It may be in very diffuse and subliminal form, but I would agree. Yeah, I think that will have to be taken account of at some stage.
Well, if you think that consciousness is something that arises from the electrical impulses in your brain, it would be fire. Because it's like an electrical impulse.
But the consciousness would be fire. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, consciousness would be energy. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think that consciousness has anything to do with electrical impulses in the brain.
Well, that's what happens when you're thinking. Just from that point of view.
Well, if you're thinking, you have electrical impulses in your brain.
Nervous things.
Sure, you also have lots of other things that happen in your brain that aren't electrical impulses, and a lot of other things that happen in a lot of other places.
I'm assuming thoughts are consciousness. That's what you're assuming, aren't you?
No, not necessarily. I think it's a sort of thing, but it's certainly thinking that thoughts are associated with a form of consciousness or conscious activity.
Yeah,
It's so sad that they're not consciousness, then it's not just.
Again, in the sense that we're talking about it, the consciousness is the awareness of the thoughts.
Yeah. Not the thoughts themselves.
Yeah.
That's what I was meaning.
For the lay, it's most interesting. I don't want to get into this too, because this would go for so long to talk about this mind. But the irreducible mind, if you haven't read it,
brilliant.
Awesome. Yeah? Irreducible mind. It's like really thick. It's printed in really small font, really tightly against the page, with lots of footnotes and hundreds of pages with dense references to all kinds of studies. And published a few years ago, Irreducible Mind, if you haven't read it. If you're wondering why the world has seemed that much less awesome the last few years, it's because all the awesome is being sucked out of it and put into this one book. And that really, really kind of systematically and quite powerfully attack this reductionist notion of the mind and the brain. Very strong evidential base. Okay, so another one of the fields of wisdom, very important one, dependent origination. And so when we're looking at dependent origination, we're looking at the observing patterns of relationships. Okay, this is the essence of what dependent origination is about. You're observing the patterns of relationships. This being, that is, this arising, that arises. This not being, that is not. This ceasing, that ceases. So this is the abstract statement of dependent origination, which we find very commonly in the early Buddhist texts, and of course is usually fleshed out with the full 12 factors of dependent origination. And unfortunately, I don't have time to go through all the 12 factors of dependent origination right now. I know. So anyway, I did do about, I think, 4 months or 6 months of talks at Santi Monastery 1 year on dependent origination, so you can look them up if you want. But this, again, if you remember earlier this morning when we looked at the process of understanding, jnana parinya, understanding what's known, understanding by scrutiny, and understanding by abandoning. And you can see that the understanding of what's known, you know, if you can apply that to things like the elements or the senses and things like that, you actually know what is this experience like, what is earth like, what is water like, what is fire like, what is the eye like, what is the ear like, what are those things like in and of themselves. And then the scrutiny is to understand them through dependent origination. What are the relationships between them? What happens when this happens? What then happens? How does this work? When I use my mind in that way, what's the result? When I think that, what happens to it? When I see this, how do I feel? When I feel that way, how do I think? Yeah? And so these is all these connections which are constantly going on in the mind. And of course, one of the big problems in developing this depth of wisdom is because our minds are so complex, right? And we tend to have so many thoughts and memories and feelings and all of these things going through our mind in very complex ways all the time. So it becomes very difficult to unravel that and to make sense of it. And so this is why we start through the meditation, calming the mind down. Yeah, so we just calm everything down, make it more clear, so that we can see things better. Yeah. But then we also help that process of wisdom by just investigating all of the individual things. Take the simple things and look at them clearly and straightforwardly to begin with. Yeah, take the very basic things. Yeah, listen. If you're sitting in meditation, just listen to sounds. Yeah, just take one thing. Just listen to sounds. What's it like? Oh, I can feel that there's something in here that we call an ear, and that receives the sounds. And there's a sound which is out there. And you just investigate that. What does it feel like? What does my ear feel like? What is that sound? What is that light? What's the quality of that thing that makes it a sound? Yeah? And then you realize that there's a consciousness that arises because of that. There's a particular quality of awareness which is aware of sound. And that quality of awareness is something like the awareness of sights and smells and so on. But actually it's also kind of different. Yeah? And sounds are quite a different kind of thing to all of those others. And so you say, what kind of thing is that? What is sound consciousness like? You investigate that. And saying you investigate, you just reflect on it. You hold it in mind. You're aware of it. You sit in meditation. Just keep your awareness on that sound. What is that like? And then you begin to notice things. For example, you begin to notice how your mind wants to conceptualize around that sound, right? So then you begin to notice this nama rupa. Yeah? You have the sound. Oh, that's a car. Ah, oh, tweet, tweet, that's a bird. Yeah? You hear the door opening. Oh, that so-and-so has got home. Yeah? So you begin to see how your mind wants to conceptualize around things. You want to give a name for every sound. Yeah? Oh, okay. So you gradually begin to unwind these things, and you begin to unwind that tendency. You say, oh, then such and such sound I like. Yeah, I hear the car. I don't like that sound. I hear a bird. I like that sound. You notice your mind moves backwards and forwards in relation to these things. And this is where you're seeing the dependent origination. You're seeing the craving coming in, the feeling, the craving, the grabbing hold of things. You know, when you notice when the chainsaw starts up and then you don't like that sound and then it ends and then there's a sense of relief and there's an attachment to the absence of that sound, yeah? And you just sit there, oh, okay. Gradually you start to understand how the sound works. And you just stay with that and be patient with that, keep on contemplating that in different ways. And as that contemplation becomes deeper and more clear, then you can extend it to look at the different senses, and then you can contemplate how those different senses are, but also how that they relate to each other. Huh? How, for example, a sound can evoke an image. Right? Or we can think of a person, we can have a memory or think of a person, and then we might remember that person's voice or that person's face or something like that. And so we begin to see the interconnection between all of these things. And gradually as we do this, you know, you begin to realize what a curious world it is that we live in. And there's this wonderful simile that the Buddha gave for the six senses. He says it's like, there's this sutta called the six animals sutta. And he said it's like the, I can't remember what the animals are like now, but it's like, imagine you've got a bird and a crocodile and a dog and a snake and a few couple of other birds, other animals, and tied them all up together and left them. Right, you know, that's what the six senses are like, yeah. And that's so true. Actually, six senses are completely different kinds of things, and somehow they all just get bunged into our body. Why do we have these senses? Why don't we have radar, for example? Right? Hey, maybe we could have had radar. That would have been cool. We could see our way around in the dark. But you know, evolution didn't go down that train. You know, bats have radar and we don't, or sonar or whatever. So actually we might have had different senses, but we actually happen to have these ones. And this is what we build up our world out of. And that world-creating activity is a constant effort, right? That we don't notice. Actually, you don't just walk into a room and see this is a person, right? It actually is an extremely difficult and sophisticated activity that your brain and your mind has to do in order to get this sight and filter it through and put it all together and get the sounds and get it and put it all together and make it all work and somehow come out with that recognition that this is a person. We know how hard this is because we know how difficult it is to do the same thing using computer software, right? And you know that if you, when you're talking on the phone and you know, you're using some voice recognition or something like that, and you say, you know, Sydney Airport, and they come back and say, did you mean Parramatta Road? Sydney Airport. Did you mean Circular Quay? And it's very hard to do these things. It's very hard. And that's what our mind is doing effortlessly. We think it's effortlessly, right? All the time, right? And of course, we also see examples of what happens when that breaks down, right? So perhaps if someone gets very sick, yeah? My mother had an episode a while ago. She had this dissociative episode. She just sort of forgot where she was and who she was with or anything like that, and just kind of wandering around the place and thought, they had to say, come on, let's go off to the hospital now. And she's like, oh, okay, we'll go to the hospital. And she stayed there and she got better, but this. All that ability to recognize things and so on just broke down for a while. And so that's an actual effort that we're having to make constantly to construct a world that makes sense and that we can live in and that we can function in. Yeah? This is what our mind is doing all the time. So this is a process of developing wisdom. We understand that, and to understanding that we learn to let go. Right? And this is then moving to that pahana parinya. Then you begin to realize, oh, okay, that's all there is. Yeah? Actually, oh, this is what's happening. And you begin to understand that because we're acting within this world, when we make choices, this is how the world is always conditioned. When we make choices, those choices are always impermanent. They lead to impermanent results, and there's always suffering involved in that. And so that deeper wisdom, as it goes deeper and deeper, begins to understand everything we do will always result in suffering. And so then there's a letting go that comes from that. But we didn't get a chance to have a look at the suttas we're going to look at. Maybe we'll, when we wrap up. But we're just about time for our afternoon tea. So let's break and have the afternoon tea, and we'll come back for the next discussion group at 3:30.